speaking with Jonathan Haidt, whose new book is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. My sense is that your analysis of the political divide has very personal roots. You say you were a solid liberal, at least until you really started looking into the underlying moral values of liberals and conservatives, which made you reevaluate your own core political beliefs. What happened?
Well, I guess you could say that a lot of my research has been driven by moralistic anger or even hate. I came to political consciousness during, the Nixon and Ford and years. I didn't get to vote for Carter. First time I got to vote was 84. Spent my young adulthood hating Republicans, watching as the Democrats seemed to just blow it in election after election. And I actually, in 2004, I actually turned to politics. I had been studying morality and how it varies across cultures, but I turned to politics in part because I wanted to help the Democrats understand what they weren't understanding about conservative morality. And I used the tools of cultural psychology that I had learned from working with Richard Schwader, an anthropologist at Chicago. And I was trying to explain how conservatism made sense to conservatives and what liberals needed to know about it. And as I got deeper and deeper into it, I realized that they are actually right about many things, just as liberals are right about many things.
Well, you actually go further than that in your book. You say that Republicans understand moral psychology and Democrats don't.
Well, that's right. I think most Democrats, if they look back on the sorry state of the party over the last few decades, will shake their head in agreement with that. The Republicans have just done a much better job of making appeals to the gut, making appeals that resonate emotionally rather than cerebrally. And politics, like so much else in life, is not a matter of calculation. It's not like shopping and finding the best bargain. It's a lot more like religion.
You're saying that we actually develop our core beliefs not through rational deduction. We don't sort of work it out in our head and figure out what's right. Mostly, it's some gut reaction, and then later on, we justify it.
Well, that's right. I mean, how could we work it out reasonably? You need some first principles. You need some pole star. And as much as we might want to think that we steer by our own moral compass, the findings in social psychology, that's my field, show that boy, if we've got a compass, it is affected by the vast electromagnetic storm that is all the other people around us. We are much more like lemmings than we are like mavericks able to do whatever they think right. So we have feelings. We have feelings that are influenced by the culture that we grew up in, by the teams that we're part of. And then we trade reasons with each other. We're always reasoning. I'm not saying we don't reason. But we reason to prepare for our day in court. We reason to defend ourselves. We're not very good at reasoning to weigh up all the pros and cons and decide which policy will yield the best results overall.
So what does this have to do with politics then, and specifically the way conservatives as opposed to liberals approach politics?
Much of my research in moral psychology with my colleagues at yourmorals.org has been to map out what are the taste buds of the moral mind. Just as any cuisine has to appeal to a tongue that has five taste buds on it, all around the world we all have the same taste buds, but we don't eat the same foods. Our cuisines differ. And in the same way, we find that liberal cuisine tends to rest most heavily on a taste bud which you could call care or care, harm, compassion, suffering, all those sorts of issues. So liberals rest primarily on that, with also a fair amount of fairness, where fairness is equality, and liberty, where liberty is fighting against oppression. So there's a set of moral concerns, and then policies grow out of that. Policies are justified with reference to that. Conservatives have all of those moral taste buds. They rely less on the care one. They're not quite as compassionate, not quite as bleeding heart, but they have some others that liberals don't use as much, especially group loyalty, respect for authority, and a sense of sanctity or purity. So in a sense, conservatives have a broader moral palette. It doesn't mean it's better. It just means that they respond to more moral flavors. And so when politicians are appealing to the left or the right, there's just more anchors, more hooks, more flavors they can give to the right.
So you're saying those moral messages stick more with conservative voters?
Well, you can certainly get appeals about race or oppression. You can trigger quite a lot of anger on both sides. But one of the unique things about national politics, I think we should differentiate between presidential politics and congressional. Congressional politics is dirty business. We don't hold our congressmen in high repute. It's an ugly business of getting as much stuff as you can for the district. Presidential politics is different, though. The president is the high priest of the nation. And when we elect a president, it's a national ritual. The president has to go through certain rites and cite the founding fathers and our founding documents. It is, as several sociologists have observed, national politics is a lot more like religion. It's a kind of a civil religion. And my view is that the Republican Party and conservatives more generally are just constitutionally better suited to play that religious role. Democrats are more likely to treat it like a policy question and, you know, Al Gore saying, well, you know, this policy will do this and we'll get you that much percentage back. And that's not really what presidential politics is all about.
Well, if candidates should not appeal mainly to the policies that they are espousing, what should they appeal to? Presidential candidates.
Well, by should, let's just if we're talking about how to win an election, yes, I'll accept your question. If we're talking about how you really should run a country for the best long-term outcome, I would say you've got to have the policies, of course. You've got to have some good ideas, but you won't get to even play with those policies if you can't sell them. And I think many on the left will be disappointed or share my disappointment with Obama, who is such a great orator and is so smart and has such a good head for policy and ran such a great and inspiring campaign. And then when he got into the White House, got so consumed, oh, perhaps that's the reason, but just got so consumed that he failed to continue to make the emotionally compelling arguments throughout his presidency. So you've got to do both.
Give me some examples of this. What are the emotional arguments that Obama is not making?
Well, let's take the central issue of this election, which is even more central now that Ryan is the VP on the Republican side, and that is fiscal issues. And fiscal issues are moral issues. It's not just some math or accounting question. It's a question of what is the role of government and how what are we going to do here. We're in huge trouble in this country. We are so vastly overspent. We're in huge trouble. And I think the Simpson-Bowles Committee was right. We've got to cut a hell of a lot, and we've got to raise taxes, and we've got to do more cutting than raising. Now, the Republicans come along, and they say, well, we're going to do it all with tax cuts. And I think that's crazy. You can't. But Obama should be saying, we've all got to give here. We're in big trouble, and we've all got to give. People are going to have to give up some benefits, and the rich are going to have to pay more taxes. This is what great leaders do. Winston Churchill didn't come in and say, I promise you that 98% of you won't have to suffer when we fight the Germans, but the other 2% are going to give blood, sweat, toil, and tears. That's not how Churchill led. And Obama has been saying from the time he was elected, we're in big trouble here, and don't worry, everyone, I'm going to protect all of you, but we got to raise taxes on the rich. That's not an emotional appeal. That is an appeal, that is a divisive appeal, actually. I wish he would say, we've all got to give, and that means the middle class too.
But that sounds like a policy argument here. I mean, it doesn't sound like you're really making an emotional appeal.
No, that's a very deep emotional appeal. The miracle of human social life is that we're able to cooperate under very special circumstances. Now, of course, we cooperate with our kin, with our family. That's what we're programmed to do. That's easy. The miracle is that we can cooperate with strangers. And we do that under very special circumstances. One is when we're attacked by a foreign enemy. We're very good at coming together. And another is just in general when we can be rallied to say we're all in this together. Everyone's got to give, and as long as you trust that everyone is giving, then you're willing to give. Because you would look like a cheater. People will hate you if everyone is contributing except for you. But if the appeal is we're in big trouble here, and I'm gonna protect all of you except for a few percent, well, that's not an emotional appeal. Think of it as though there's a button buried deep in our heads, which is the we're in big trouble. Cooperate as long as everyone else is cooperating. That's the button that Obama isn't pushing. It's a button that Bush didn't push after 9/11. So it's a bipartisan failure to appeal to our better nature, I think.
Of course, one of the mantras of the left is that many working class voters mistakenly vote against their own class interests by supporting conservative politicians who support tax cuts that disproportionately benefit very rich people. And basically the complaint is that these working class voters have somehow been duped. What do you make of that argument?
It's a complicated argument, and I have mixed feelings about it. The basic facts are that the working class tends to vote Democratic overall. As people get richer, they do vote more Republican. So there is an element of self-interest in protecting your own wealth, but it's also a moral argument. The interesting thing to me is that even though most of the bottom third of the country votes for the Democrats, if you look at people, if you look at white people who have jobs but don't have a college degree, basically the white working class defined in that way, these are little guys. These are the guys that the Democratic Party traditionally has stood for since Andrew Jackson. And those people generally are Republicans. They often hate the Democrats. And it's not because they're duped. I mean, there's a lot of trickery on both sides. Both sides demagogue, the Democrats demagogue on healthcare issues. But fiscal issues are also economic issues. And a lot of these guys, a lot of these working class people are saying, I don't want to live in a country in which I work my ass off, but anyone who chooses not to can get a bailout. That is a disgusting kind of country to me. So I'm not going to vote for the party that allows that. Now, that's an exaggeration, but there is some truth to it. And so it's not just that they're duped. It's that there are very different views of personal responsibility, and the Democrats have generally been weak on that topic.
So as you lay out these different mindsets, I mean, really you're saying that these are the core moral values of conservatives, and these are the core moral values of liberals. Do you see yourself as a kind of cultural translator, showing people how they can talk to each other, how they can talk across the political divide?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm hoping that my book will do. You know, I started this work to help one side, to help the Democrats understand the Republicans so they could beat them. But in the process, as I've come to listen to everyone, as I've tried to just get inside people's heads to make sense of it, just to describe it, that's my job as a scientist, that's fed back on me as a person. And I've found that I now take moral psychology really seriously. And so the first third of my book isn't about politics at all. It's about the basic nature of reasoning and how we try to confirm whatever it is that we start off believing. And we're always able to do that. So the only way that you can think well is if you can have other people on the other side to disconfirm your pet theories. And so this is what's happened to me now, is I feel like, wow, if you understand moral psychology, then you can see how flawed all of us are on all sides and why our good thinking requires talking openly and listening to people on the other side. That's what I'm hoping my book will do, that people will read it and say, you know what, talking about religion and politics, that's not a bad thing to do. It actually is the most interesting possible thing to do, because it's like all these good ideas that you never even were exposed to because you're locked in your own sort of your own gated moral community.
And yet, it's so hard to talk across this divide. I mean, people are more polarized than ever. I mean, this country is more ideologically divided than in any time I can remember. How do you break through?
Well, first, let's just note that the polarization now, while it's unique in its way, things were really, really bad in the 19th century. I mean, leading up to the Civil War and afterwards. And Congress was just as dysfunctional, just as polarized in the 19th century. But there was an unusual period from the 30s through the 70s in which it wasn't. We'd fought two world wars. Again, people, you all pull together when you've got a foreign enemy. So we had the greatest generation that really was able to talk across the divide, and they've been replaced by the baby boomers in our political life who are not able to talk across the divide. So things are different now, different than anybody remembers who's alive today, but there is precedent in our history, and we've gotten through it. Things shift around. The danger is that now, for the first time in our history, the parties are not coalitions of, say, northern industrialists with western ranchers or whatever. I mean, parties used to always be coalitions of interest groups. Now, for the first time, we have a perfect psychological split. All the people with a liberal personality and liberal values that go with it are in one party. All the people with a more conservative personality or disposition, actually libertarian and conservative, those two dispositions, are in the other party. And that means that for the first time, the people in the other party really are different. They think differently from each other. They value different things. They watch different shows on TV. They travel and do leisure in different ways. They're really different people. They're really different cultures. And that's dangerous because it makes it extra easy to demonize them.
Well, and it seems to me that the task here, I mean, if we really care about civil discourse and ultimately about a healthier political scene is not just to beat the people we don't like, but to figure out how to talk with them and meaningfully. I mean, to how to have political disagreements and talk about this honestly and to get somewhere new and hopefully better.
That's right. And that's why I think the way to do this is to think about indirect methods. There are all these efforts to bring people together to reason and talk and argue and discourse. And I don't ever want to get involved with them. There's not much evidence that they work when they focus on the nature of the discussion itself. I'm much more interested in a few efforts that try to build relationships first. There are some efforts that try to bring people together over food. Food is one of these deep things. When you eat with people at the same table, it activates ancient circuits of trust. You're saying we are like family. So I suggest indirect methods focus on relationships first and then gradually introduce policy questions or other political questions. So use people's friendship networks. There's a group, livingroomconversations.org. There's a group, The Village Square in Tallahassee. There are some groups that are doing this, and I put a lot more faith in those.
Or you could try it around the family Thanksgiving table when you get together with relatives who you might not see very often.
Yes, but I would say don't try this alone. Don't try this at home on your own without a professional with you. So if you read the book, I don't want to just put in a shameless plug for the book, but if you read the book, then you can start off a conversation saying, hey, you know, I read this book. You know, suppose you're a liberal talking to a conservative. I read this book. And so rather than just coming at them saying, why do you believe X if you also believe Y? I mean, that's the standard form of political attack. Rather than that, if you go and you say, you know, I read this book which said that conservatives are really concerned about personal responsibility. You know, tell me about that. Do you see both parties as fostering that? And if you make that sort of opening, which shows that you're not attacking, you're trying to understand, you often are met with a reciprocal gesture in which, say, you know, your brother-in-law might say, yeah, you know, the Democrats, they've always been against personal responsibility. But then he might soften him and say, you know, on the other hand, the Republicans, you know, so the way they bail out the banks, they haven't been so good on it either. So you got to get reciprocity and acknowledgement working for you. Don't just recreate the normal form of political engagement, which is a fight.
It seems to me there's another way to explain why we have become so polarized in this country, and that's basically because we've been in this financial crisis for at least half a decade. We have less money. We are more fearful. There's a greater tendency to scapegoat the other side. Basically, people get angrier when there's less to go around.
I would say that that does amplify things, yes. There's a really nice book by Tom Edsel, The Age of Austerity. But the roots of this rapidly rising polarization, I mean, it's been going up and up and up steadily since the 70s. The major causes are the perfect alignment of the parties. Of course, the South was Democratic and conservative because they hated Lincoln. And as that ended after Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, the South shifted to the Republicans. And now we had a perfect sort. I mean, there are a lot of causes going back to the 60s, 70s, 80s. Newt Gingrich made some innovations in Congress to make it a much more confrontational place, which I think really damaged the institution. So most of the causes were in place long before the financial crisis hit. And then it's our national tragedy that even as we were, you know, we should have been preparing for the baby boomers' retirement, and I will never forgive George Bush for squandering the surplus. So even as we should have been preparing, we weren't. And then this tsunami hits in which we lose vast sums of money. We have to spend vastly more. So yeah, we're in big trouble, and that has a feedback loop, a negative feedback loop with our polarization.
It seems to me that you are also making a larger argument here, and to some degree counteracting what has been the assumption ever since the Enlightenment, 300 or 400 years ago, that reason is king. There has been this steady movement away from religion, from traditional forms of authority, more towards individual rights, secular values. It's been kind of the march of society in the West. Are you saying that perhaps that's mistaken?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I majored in philosophy as an undergraduate, and I kept reading philosophers talking about reason in Plato, talking about our divine reason implanted in our heads by the gods. And then I went into psychology, where we see over and over again that it's not that we're totally irrational. I mean, if we, you know, want to get from point A to point B in the fastest way possible, we're pretty good at figuring it out. But a lot of people will have heard of behavioral economics or Dan Kahneman's book Thinking Fast and Slow or Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink. The bottom line is that we are an incredible species of geniuses at solving problems by intuition, parallel processing, and pattern matching. We can do incredible things that computers will never be able to copy. But when it comes to objectively weighing costs and benefits and adding them up, when our reputation or our group membership is at play, that we're really bad at. And so appeals that try to say, well, let's try to make kids more rational. Let's teach them critical thinking. They did that a lot in the 80s, and there's not much evidence that it worked. You can't teach people to think better.
Isn't that what education's all about, to teach students how to think better?
Well, a lot of people on the left think that our goal should not be to tell them what to think. It should be teaching them how to think, but that's not quite true. You need a hell of a lot of actual knowledge about history, about literature, and you can see various patterns playing out. You can't teach people to reason better. You can teach them statistics. That's the one area where it's been shown that you can actually improve people's thinking about statistics. But logic, not really. What I think we should be doing is cultivating better intuitions. For example, what I would really like to see happening is in civics classes, sure, teach how a bill becomes law, but also teach the long history of the parties and of the left-right divide internationally and show that both sides are often right. Both sides are – they see different threats. Rather than shying away from this, because I guess you're probably afraid that the parents, you know, parents might get upset, but there must be some way to teach – to teach a respectful view in which both sides have something to contribute. So I'd like to see it starting early, people grabbing the bull by the horns, as it were, and saying, you know, look, this is the way our political system works, and these are the philosophies, and read some good works on both sides. Let's cultivate some respect. That will end up helping people think better, but that's not just teaching them to reason better.
I don't exactly see this distinction here. It sounds like that's teaching critical thinking skills.
What I'm arguing in the book, principle number one in moral psychology is intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. So if people approach this basically hating the other side and you teach them to reason better, all they will do is come up with better arguments why the other side is so stupid and evil. There's a lot of research on reasoning which shows that as IQ goes up, as people get smarter and smarter, they don't think better in the sense of looking at arguments on both sides. Rather, they become better and better lawyers. So I'm saying rather than focusing our efforts on critical thinking skills, which will just make people better lawyers, we should focus more on the intuitive experiences in which people might get, high school kids might get some feeling of respect towards various people, various leaders, various parties, various ideas.
Don't moral values also change? I mean, I'm thinking about an issue like gay rights. And if you think back, 30 years ago, homosexuality made a lot of people uncomfortable in a way that it really no longer does for a large segment of the American population.
That's right. And that's a great example of what we're talking about here. Cuisines change at about the same speed. Over the course of a decade or two, a cuisine can change and a moral issue like gay marriage can change. In America now, we eat a lot more salsa than we used to. It's not that our taste buds changed, but the cuisine changed. Same thing with gay marriage. Now, did it change because people were exposed to all of these good arguments about rights and marriage? Is that what changed it? Or is it because gay people were in the closet for centuries, and in the 70s and 80s, the gay liberation movement brought them out into the open, and people realized, oh, my God, my brother-in-law is gay, or, oh, this character on TV. Once it becomes commonplace, once you know people, you lose the disgust. You lose the sense of bizarreness that people 20 or 30 years ago felt. And once the feelings are gone, then your mind is open to the reasons.
So it's not because people came to the rational conclusion that there's nothing wrong with gay rights or people being gay. It was just you knew someone.
Well, I would say both are necessary, but the feelings need to come first. As long as people are disgusted by something, it's very difficult to reason them out of it. So if you want an intervention campaign, start with the emotions. If you want to get people to smoke less, start by cultivating disgust and fear. Of course, you need to give the evidence and the reasons about cancer as well, but just giving the reasons about long-term health isn't going to do it as well as changing the feelings will.
So you said earlier that you used to be a diehard liberal. In fact, you sort of fantasized about what you would tell John Kerry, you know, as he was running his presidential campaign. Are you still a liberal?
I mean, I'm a liberal by temperament and disposition. And if you watched me live my life and, you know, the way my wife and I, you know, what we like to do with our free time and all that stuff, yeah, I would look like a liberal. But in terms of policies, I now think both parties are so screwed up and so corrupt and so in the pocket of Wall Street. Both parties are sensitive to a couple of big threats, but they're so blind to the big threats on the other side that, no, I'm sort of a anti-partisan nowadays. I'm opposed to both parties and I'm opposed to people who are strongly partisan on either side, I suppose you could say.
So what do conservatives need to know about liberals and what do liberals need to know about conservatives?
What I think conservatives need to know about liberals is that they are sensitive to victims and threats. They're sensitive to people who get ground down by the system, who don't fit in. They're like canaries in the coal mine for detecting oppression. And if you don't have liberals looking out at every step, I mean, what conservatives would care about people being beaten and raped in prison? Nobody. I mean, I shouldn't say nobody, but it's not high on the conservative priority list. But wherever people are powerless and are being victimized, liberals are usually there. And if you don't have and you got to have some respect for that mission. If you don't have people fulfilling that function, you've just got millions and millions of people being beaten, being ignored, being humiliated. And that was the case for gay people in this country for so long. I mean, literally getting beaten as teenagers. So I think liberals play an extraordinary humanitarian role in our country and around the world. Conservatives, in contrast, are like canaries in the coal mine for the loss of order, for the loss of social or moral capital. That is, while liberals are trying to loosen things up and get more rights for the accused, oppose police brutality, all those important things, they often go too far, and you need conservatives to say, hey, wait a second. You've got to have a system in which crime is punished, in which bad deeds go punished, in which personal irresponsibility leads to ruin. If you don't have that, everything decays and we're all worse off. So both sides are sensitive to different kinds of threats. Both sides are sincerely morally motivated. And, you know, it's like you can't look at a complex object from all sides at once. You got to sort of stand on one side and say, oh, yeah, look, I see that side. And then you walk around and say, oh, yeah, I see that side too. So you need both wings here. And we haven't even mentioned libertarians, who are our third perspective, neither liberal nor conservative, normally much closer to liberal. But libertarians are so offended by the welfare state and the wastefulness and the way it saps initiative that they end up voting Republican, even though my colleagues and I, we have evidence that libertarian personality is actually more like liberal personality than like conservative.
Okay, this all makes a lot of sense, the way you've just laid
it out. Well,
thank
you.
And yet, most people don't seem to act this way. And why is it so hard for people to see the other side, to really understand the other side and not just try to say they're wrong?
I'm guessing that a lot of your listeners have seen the movie The Matrix, or one of those variants, or at least they know that scene with the red pill and the blue pill, and they've heard The Matrix, as William Gibson defined it, is a consensual hallucination, and this is the miracle of our species that we create these consensual hallucinations. I mean, watch kids play; they can just in 20 seconds they can weave this imaginary scenario and both jump into it, and then they're playing for half an hour in it, and then it's time for dinner, they leave and they go elsewhere. So we're really good at this. This is why we are able to have civilization. But the downside of it is that we can't really have one giant shared global consensual hallucination that brings us all together into a single trusting moral community until the day we're attacked by Martians. Until before that happens, we're going to be doomed to being in lots of separate matrices. And when you have competition and electoral politics is a zero-sum game, there's a lot at stake. You got two teams fighting over it. You're going to have these separate consensual hallucinations, liberalism and conservatism, and subversions of each. And they're going to cooperate in order to fight each other.
Now, a lot of people would say that the political system right now is basically broken. It's just really hard to do anything innovative anymore, given the entrenched interests on various sides. Are you hopeful?
In the medium term and short term, no, I'm not at all hopeful. I see no reason for hope whatsoever. In the long term, I'm moderately hopeful in that we've been here before. Polarization has risen and fallen once or twice in our history. We have gone from the greatest generation, which was the best suited for cooperation and putting the common good ahead of individual good. We went from a post-war period where they ran things to a more recent period where the baby boomers ran things, and they are the least suited. I mean, I can't blame them. The world as they saw it was broken, needed fixing. But we don't know what will happen when the millennials take over. They've been criticized for being unable to make moral judgments. You know, they're always saying, whatever, or who am I to judge? And there's some ugliness to that. But coming after the baby boomers and their hyper-moralization and culture wars, who knows what will happen in 20 or 30 years? There could be a reaction. The one thing we know for sure is that big, unexpected things are going to happen, probably bad things, but maybe some good things too, and that's going to shake everything up. So, you know, in the long run, I think America has good fundamentals. I'm moderately optimistic over the 20 to 40-year horizon.
Okay, that is great. Thank you. And my producer, Sarah, has one question she wants me to ask, so hang on just a moment. Okay, let me rephrase that question. Do you think the Democratic and Republican parties are trying to communicate past their own base to broaden their appeal, or are they just appealing to their core supporters?
Mm-hmm. It varies depending on the election. The strategy in American politics, as I understand it, has traditionally been you need to get the middle in order to get the majority. But beginning with the 2004 election, Karl Rove developed the idea that, no, you just got to energize your base, get higher turnout than the other side. From what I understand about the current election, I just heard Larry Sabato at UVA talking about this. There are very few undecideds out there right now. Almost everybody is leaning one way or the other. And so this election is going to come down to who can turn out their base, who can turn out their followers the most. So I think both sides are really focusing on messages that are going to appeal to their core values. So we saw this in January in the battle over birth control, in which the left was saying, oh, it's a war on women. So you take a historical victim group and you show how the right wants to put them back in chains, put them back in the Stone Age, keep them barefoot and pregnant. So that's a pretty straightforward appeal to victimization and to a major base group, women. Whereas on the right, they said, no, it's not a war on women. It's a war on religion. Look, they're going to force Catholic schools to pay for birth control and So the right tends to own patriotism and religion and family, and so they were painting the left as a threat to their sacred values, and the left is painting the right as a threat to its sacred values, and on it goes.
So you're saying there's really not much space in this environment right now to make a broader argument, and basically to try to create a bigger tent under which vying interests live.
That's right. Right now, there's not much room for that. And this is in part because things are really evenly matched right now. They're really evenly split. I've heard some political scientists say that back when the Democrats basically controlled Congress completely, it was easier to be bipartisan because the Republicans didn't really have a chance of taking over. Right now, one of the big problems is that in Congress, whoever has a majority gets to make all the rules. It is really good to be in the majority. It's terrible to go in the minority. So they will fight tooth and nail now that things shift back and forth. They will fight tooth and nail. Their top priority is not helping the country. Their top priority is avoiding losing and going into the minority. That's the worst thing that could happen.
Well, on that sobering note, thank you very much.